So our guest today, John Summers, is a visiting scholar here at the Boisy Center this year, where he's spending the year working on a biography of 20th century sociologist C. Wright Mills. He's also the editor of a much-discussed collection of Mills' writings entitled The Politics of Truth, published last year from Oxford University Press. John has published widely in journals ranging from the New York Times Book Review to the Journal of American History, and he writes a monthly column for the Times Higher Education, based in London. A collection of his essays, Every Fury on Earth, Exhibit A, was published in 2008 as well. Prior to his arrival here at the Boisy Center, John taught at Harvard University and currently teaches at Columbia University as a lecturer on American Studies. Born and raised in Gettysburg, PA, he received his doctorate in history from the University of Rochester. His talk today is based on an article he recently published in the March 18th edition of The New Republic, which is there called Gettysburg Regress. And here, his talk is entitled Gettysburg in Rehab. So welcome, John.
Thank you. Thank you, Eric, very much. And thank you all for coming. And the broadest gratitude goes to Alan and Eric and Susie and Suzanne for their kind hospitality all throughout this year. It's been a pleasurable and productive year. I appreciate the chance to be part of the center. I'm an American historian by training, as Eric mentioned, and although most of the time I deplore and despair over the fact of specialization, today I'm going to take refuge in mine. I am an historian of 20th century America, which is to say that I'm not responsible for any of the details about the American Civil War, or especially the tactical and strategic nuances of the Battle of Gettysburg. But I think that all historians eventually have to confront the nature of our obligations to the dead and gone. This is our main subject, after all, those who have come before, the dead and the worlds that they inhabited. In our public monuments and our historical sites, the issue comes to us by the name of commemoration and preservation. And the battlefields are a particularly dramatic reference point. Academic historians, I think, typically treat these matters as under the rubric of what is called public history. But I think that we all should think more carefully about the matter. There was an article last week in the New York Times about a woman, I believe it was in Chicago, who was challenging the city's Landmarks Preservation Commission on the question of whether her neighborhood and its buildings deserves landmark status. I don't know if you saw that or not, but it was a very interesting piece. And one of the disclosures in the piece is that there really aren't many firm criteria for what gets preserved and commemorated in the country among most of our commissions, our urban commissions in particular. There's just not a lot of good thinking about these kind of subjects. My interest in this respect has a couple of different components. Last January, the year before this past January, I was walking with my wife in Gettysburg's Seminary Ridge when an odd detail drew into sight. There were piles of felled trees stacked along the road. My wife inspected them, and the cuts smelled fresh. The trees actually looked very strong. We were exceedingly puzzled. Seminary Ridge is one of a string of ridges surrounding the town. General Robert E. Lee had stood there on July 2nd and 3rd, 1863. And the woods atop the ridge had made it a sublime place to stroll for as long as I could remember, until that walk we took, which was ended when a logging truck lumbered by. So we were confronted with the specter of logging in a national park. So I returned to Gettysburg last summer to ask around. As Eric mentioned, I grew up in Gettysburg, and my interest in the battlefield itself dates to my high school years in the 1980s when I worked as a tour guide for the Gettysburg Battlefield Tour Center, one of a couple of commercial operations operating in the park. I was imparting the names and the dates and the locations of the battle, although these were by and large irrelevant to the moral history of the war, and that was fine with me. I remember very well loading the customers into the fleet of blue and gray double-decker buses, climbing on top of the buses, putting my headphones on, and sunning myself. So asking around town last summer, I learned that parts of the battlefield were in rehabilitation, which is the key word in the hope of providing visitors with an authentic historical experience, the National Park Service was seeking to restore some of Gettysburg's landscapes to their condition immediately before the Union and Confederate armies clashed on them. The goal, as a National Park Service official told the Christian Science Monitor last April, was to, quote, make visitors almost feel the bullets. That is what you want to have happen in a battlefield. So now I had an interesting subject in a number of respects. My wife was upset about the trees. I had a chance to revisit the battlefield of my fast-fading youth. And more important, I had the enviable chance to confront a consensus as complete and as unified as it was possible to imagine. The rehabilitation project absolutely delights the tens of thousands of reenactors who come to Gettysburg every year, as well as the tourists who expect to less to encounter history than to experience it. Academic historians also approve. Eric Foner and James McPherson serve as advisors to the project. University of Virginia professor Gary Gallagher, another advisor to the project, cheered in last month's Civil War Times that, quote, there has never been a better time to visit Gettysburg. Those who might object to the removal of the trees, he says, are people who don't understand the difference between an historic park and Yosemite. Rehabilitation has something for everyone. It flatters the left's suspicion of cultural authority. It's an invitation to ordinary Americans to participate in their history, even as it honors conservatism's fetish for an unchanged, historically correct past. So we thought we saw something larger, sort of a distinctive pattern of thought sweeping across the battlefield in sympathy with the changing expectations Americans apply to their history. But consider the Gettysburg Address, in which President Lincoln cautioned, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here, have consecrated it, far above our poor power to add or detract. In this season of Lincoln, it seemed worth asking whether rehabilitating Gettysburg to its original state is really a process of adding or detracting, and whether the managers of our battlefields are, in their quest for maximum historical authenticity, cheating visitors out of something much more important. So there are two objections, basically, that I launch against this, this project. The first question is practical. Is it possible to return vast tracts of land to their appearance in July of 1863? The Park Service says it's drawing on maps, participant reports of the battle, diaries, and newspaper accounts for a description of the battlefield's original condition. That sounds straightforward, but consider how little anyone knows for certain about the site's pre-war appearance. So far as I have been able to tell, only four photographs of the Gettysburg outdoors from before the battlefield, from before the battle, exist. And each of these four shows the town rather than the surrounding fields. There's just no images that we have of what the fields look like before the battle. No image of, no maps of the pre-battle farmland and countryside were known to exist as late as 1995, when William Fazzinito, the dean of Gettysburg's photographic history, published his book, Early Photography at Gettysburg, and Fazzinito is the author of these pamphlets as well. Fazzinito's chapter on cartography identified M.S. Converse's map as the only one available in July 1863. And the Converse map did not portray woods, hills, ridges, or any of the other topographical features. Brevet Major General G.K. Warren and his team of military engineers made a sweeping survey of the battlefield in 1868 and 1869, and then revised the map in 1873 and submitted it to the War Department. The Warren map is the most authoritative and widely used, but it, as Fazzinito shows, has tremendous gaps and errors. The fact is that the scale and complexity of Gettysburg has made it difficult to understand much about it, and one could say the same thing about other large events in history. There are 1,328 markers and monuments scattered about the grounds, and they are an interesting and, in fact, stellar collection of public sculpture. Some people argue that it's the largest collection of public sculpture in the world. But individually and collectively, they reflect a constructed view of a certain version of the past rather than a factual description of some historical truth. These are the words of Thomas Desjardins' book, These Honored Dead, How the Story of Gettysburg Shaped American Memory. Apocrypha that still surrounds Little Round Top and Pickett's Charge originated not in the infallible testimony of eyewitnesses, but in remembrances blurred, biased, and in some cases, invented. Desjardins argues convincingly that, quote, there is no what really happened at Gettysburg, only a mountain of varying, often contradictory accounts that are seldom in accord and are all tainted in some way or another by memory, bias, politics, ego, and a host of other factors. Nobody learned the practical limits of research faster than the battle's first historian, John Batchelder, I think his name is pronounced. He received $50,000 from Congress in 1880 to determine what had taken place and write an official history. In spite of the thousands of interviews Batchelder conducted with eyewitnesses and participants, some of them in field hospitals surrounding Gettysburg at the time, he was never able to produce the history for which he was paid. Flaws found in his maps, plus the intractable conflicts he found in a collective memory, defeated his attempt to make the story cohere. Soldiers and commanders alike said they found their experiences incomprehensible, their vision clouded by fields curtained in smoke. General Abner Doubleday wrote to Batchelder in this chastened spirit 5 years after the congressional appropriation. It is difficult in the excitement of battle to see everything going on around us, for each has his own part to play, and that absorbs his attention to the exclusion of everything else, Doubleday said. People are very much mistaken when they suppose because a man is in a battle, he knows all about it. In fact, most of what we think we know about Gettysburg is knowledge gained at several removes from the experience of the battle. Paul Philip Cho and his team painted the Gettysburg Cyclorama in 1883 from 10 photographs by William Tipton, photos that depicted the battle the battlefield as it seemed in 1882, not 1863. Photographers Matthew Brady, Alexander Gardner, and the Taylor brothers, Charles and Isaac, circulated the earliest images of the battle. At Antietam, Gardner had supplied many urban newspaper readers with their first glimpse of dead soldiers. At Gettysburg, he alone captured images of the battlefield before the battle had finished. But it's easy to forget, I think, in light of his achievement, that neither Gardner nor anyone else took photographs of the battle itself. So that's the practical objection. It goes, I think, beyond the familiar argument that our knowledge of history is limited inevitably. It's more than limited. It's virtually non-existent to build in this case, I think. Now for the second question. Suppose the evidence was overwhelming. Suppose that there was an abundance of available pictures, eyewitness accounts that were both reliable and comprehensive, and maps that could guide history's eye with flawless accuracy. The question would still remain, why should battlefield visitors want to almost feel the bullets? Earlier generations of tourists brought more modest expectations. In 1865, the Gettysburg Springs Hotel opened on heels of the news that a medicinal spring had been discovered west of town. The hotel offered 300 guests the use of an artificial lake, a billiard room, and a bowling alley. But its most visited attraction was the cupola that offered a panoramic view of the first day's fighting. This vantage point, high and apart from the grounds, was much copied. In 1878, a private developer constructed the Battlefield Prospect Tower on East Cemetery Hill, which also provided a panoramic view. The War Department raised 5 steel observation towers overlooking the battlefield. And in 1974, the developer erected a 307-foot-tall tower over Soldiers National Cemetery over the strenuous objections of preservationists. The Park Service demolished this structure. It was called the National Tower in 2000. And this was a key symbolic moment in the drive for rehabilitation. After all, think of the towers. The towers enforce a respectful moral distance between the seer and the seen. The early ones sprung up when memory of the suffering at Gettysburg was still raw. But the towers impede the ability of visitors to experience the battle, and experience is what today's battlefield managers aim to provide. Of course, to truly experience what it was like to be at Gettysburg, we would need to lie with the soldiers as they bled to death. Wild pigs feasting on their flesh, corpses overborne by maggots and strewn among breastworks, streams running red, winds swarming with flies, the air smelling of burning horseflesh. As we cannot know the precise cartography of the Gettysburg, of the battlefield, or of the movements of every soldier, or the location of every tree, so we should not try to leap backward into authenticity, or expect to become an eyewitness history, eyewitness to history, simply by showing up. The arrogance around this expectation is astonishing. At Gettysburg, as elsewhere, the parties of preservation, restoration, and rehabilitation seek to transport us forward into the past by scrubbing off the insults of time, but in offering the illusion of authentic experience, in treating history as an obstacle to understanding, they promise both too much and too little. They forget that suffering must be regarded at a distance of tragedy if it's to perform its proper function and make us modest. They substitute for the possibility of this moral knowledge the thrill of reenactment. If a battlefield is not a locus of authentic experience, then what is it? Is it a shrine or is it a classroom? These are more difficult questions that I can't pretend to answer. But the trees may teach us something yet. As with the artillery battles at Bull Run and Fredericksburg, a rainstorm followed the cessation of fire at Gettysburg. As the flesh decayed, it aerated the earth for new vegetation. What the Park Service calls, quote, non-historic trees, that is, trees which grew after 1863, once were seedlings. Since then, in the changefulness of the seasons, they have formed a palimpsest, offering the closest we may yet come to communing with the lost souls of the battle. As he gazed around him, the youth felt a flash of astonishment at the battle. Pure sky and sun gleaming on the trees and fields, Stephen Crane wrote in The Red Badge of Courage. It was surprising that nature had gone tranquilly on with her golden processes in the midst of so much devilment. Surprising, yes, but in the end, not so surprising. Most of us, like my wife Anna, intuit the connections of grief and trees. That humans plant trees on gravesites is a spiritual fact of great and ancient significance. Homer signals a transition from war to peace by telling how Odysseus, returning home from the battlefields of Troy, found his father tending a young fruit tree. Ovid, in the Metamorphoses, tells of Cypriseus, quote, begging the gods to let him grieve forever after he accidentally kills a stag. As his lifeblood drained away with never-ending tears, his limbs began to take a greenish cast, and the soft hair that used to cluster on his snow-white brow became a bristling crest. The boy was now a rigid tree with frail and spiring crown that gazes on the heavens and the stars. Those trees on Seminary Ridge were not obstructing the view, nor preventing an authentic experience, as the managers of Gettysburg prefer us to believe. They were emblems of a tragedy. They remind us of the pity and terror of war. Thank you very much.